sky's so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. Call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, hey, it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria, Ton, and Sheridan Hansen joining us this morning. Sheridan, a horticulturist who has joined us on a number of occasions to talk about all sorts of things, from heirloom tomatoes to extending the gardening season. So you can talk to her about a number of different things or ask your questions of her. We wanted to start at the top of the hour here, though, talking about gardening in small spaces. We all know that properties are getting smaller and smaller, and people still want to be able to grow their vegetables, but they don't have a lot of space. So we wanted to talk about some budget-friendly ideas for folks. But first, I guess you have to decide what you're going to plant, what
Absolutely.
You need to plant or want to plant.
Well, and I would say the top tip for somebody with a small space garden is to make sure that you plant what you love and what you know you're going to eat. You don't want to waste one single inch of space on something that you will not like or will not eat. So that space is a hot commodity. So make sure that your selections reflect that. And then, you know, after that, you know, we're looking at spacing plants, we're looking at sourcing smaller plants, we're looking at, you know, making sure that we are packing as much into that space as possible. And this is something I did when I was with USU, is I worked on an urban farm demonstration garden where we worked to pack in as much as we could in a small space as possible. We were growing vegetables in about a 2,000 square foot space, which for some people that's quite large, but for a small scale farmer, that's very small. And we were consistently harvesting between 2,000 and 3,000 pounds of food out of that space. So it can be done. You can pack a lot into that space. But you know, we just have to be mindful about what we pick. Additionally to spacing things close together and picking small varieties, there are other ways that we can do things, and that's like using vertical space, because that's not going to use that space that's spread out in the garden. I'm going to take my tomatoes, I'm going to trellis them upward, I'm going to trellis my beans and my peas upward if I can. Everything that can climb, including squashes, I'm going to push upward so that I can save that space. And I use things that are relatively inexpensive, things like what you would call a hog panel or a cattle panel. You can pick these up at local farm stores. They're not very expensive. You need a couple of T-posts and some zip ties. They're usually about 16 feet long, and you can bend them up and over a walkway, or you can use them straight down a row to kind of pull things up down a row if you don't want to have the arch that you walk underneath. There are a couple of different ways to use them, and then I will trellis and push all of those vegetables upward as much as I can. Even cucumbers we've done upward. So that's one way to save space. Another way is to utilize every other little space in your garden by placing containers, or you can interplant, which I've done a lot. You know, I had an uncle that lived in the avenues in Salt Lake. We all know how small some of those yards are. And he would interplant vegetables within his flower beds. So, you know, you'd just be walking along and there's an eggplant and there's a cherry tomato spilling over his little rock wall. And, you know, every little inch of space that you can use, definitely utilize it as you want to. But there are ways to pack these things in and really get a good harvest out of that small space.
Yeah, one of the things people can know that we did do some videos on some of these things that they can find on the KSL Greenhouse YouTube channel. But one of the interesting things from one of those videos is just how beautiful you can incorporate some of these things into like your flower bed.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they have, I think it was the peppers that uh-huh. had interesting foliage and uh-huh. fruit that really would look great with your flowers.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like even those eggplants, that's like that jewel that stands out in that garden as you're walking through. You're seeing, you know, bedding plants and perennials, and then all of a sudden you have, you know, those colored peppers or that eggplant just poking out at you. And it's interesting. It's beautiful. There is no reason that vegetables can't be incorporated into our landscape. And this is called edible landscaping. And that is something that a lot of urban, you know, in people in urban settings are doing.
You've talked about different things that we can use, different ways to place it in the yard, but there are also again, you mentioned different plants, but not the plants specifically. So what kinds of smaller varieties of things can we choose that will make a difference?
Right. So you can find, like I've kind of led to this in our last discussion. If you weren't there, this will catch you up. But there are places where you can go to source seeds, things like Burpee, Park Seed, Johnny Seeds. When you go to those websites, you're going to type in container or patio, and it will bring up a host of different plants that you can source that are for smaller spaces. They make cucumbers, mini-me's. There's a number of different cucumber varieties that are out there now. I've tried the mini-me's. Those are great. They're small. They don't vine as much as the larger cucumbers. Like if you plant a lemon cucumber, that thing is massive. It's taking over the garden, where some of these smaller type varieties will not take up nearly as much space, and they lend themselves well to a larger container. So you can get a good size container and pop them in there if you don't have space in the garden, and you can utilize them there, or you can trellis them upwards at that point as well. So, you know, when you go to these sites, make sure you're searching for smaller varieties, container or patio types.
So I want you to give us your favorite smaller type in each of kind of the different categories. So you mentioned the mini-me's.
Yes.
Now, and your favorite smaller dwarf tomato would be?
Any of the dwarf tomatoes are fabulous. I did Groovy Tunes this last year, and I absolutely loved that one. There's also a green one called Fat Frog that was really good.
Fat Frog.
I mean, they have such great names, don't they? And they, I'm like, okay, what are you saying if I like this thing
I
called
I can remember
Fat
that,
Frog?
Though, right?
Right, yeah, absolutely. most of the peppers are smaller, so you don't really need to worry about smaller variety peppers. If you want to plant one or two peppers, that's great. So this is where it comes into what can I grow successfully as well. So some of the sweet peppers are a little bit more difficult to grow. So if you don't want to really try your hand at sweet peppers and waste that space on something that you may not know how to grow quite yet, grow a hot pepper. They're a lot easier to grow. And again, small kind of plant. Things that I would steer clear from, you know, are some of these larger plants, like, you know, an heirloom tomato is very, very large. As much as I love them, they're not going to lend themselves well to that small space. So thinking about, you know, how can I get that in that smaller variety? And that's where we go to those micro dwarfs. Onions, I don't know if I'd waste space on onions. They're pretty, if you've got a very small garden, I would pick those up at the store.
I would veer toward green onions or chives.
Right. Yeah. And I don't think I'd waste my time on, you know, the bulbing onions at that point if I was dealing with a really small space.
And chives do so well.
They do. And herb gardens are fabulous in containers. So if you want to grow an herb garden, you know, do something in a container because it's beautiful too. I have an old bathtub that was left on my property when I moved in, mm-hmm. and I've turned that into my herb garden. And
wonderful.
So this old nasty iron bathtub that is so heavy to move, we moved it over to a different space in the garden where it would get sun, and that has become the site for all of my herbs.
You're thinking out of the box?
Yeah.
Out of the bathroom?
Out of the bathroom. Oh, my gosh.
It's where I do my best thinking.
Yeah. Okay. No.
So, Ton, somebody was asking about the love melons that we had mentioned in another show. Are those one of the smaller melons?
Yes,
that
they are the little single-serve melons that only get 2 or 3 feet long. So you would still need a bigger container so that you can get satisfactory rooting so you can actually get the melons. But there are several varieties of little grapefruit-sized cantaloupe and watermelon that you can also grow on patios.
Right. There's a Tigger melon as well that you can get from Baker's Creek that is small. It's like a single serving, which is awesome. And they're really fragrant and really delicious.
Tigger.
Yeah, okay. And they're striped, like what you would think about, you know, Tigger on Winnie the Pooh, kind of stripey.
Okay,
yeah.
We can remember that one
yeah.
as well. Okay, and we can continue talking about this if you have other questions that you would like to ask Sheridan or Ton. You know, I just kind of pop in every once in a while, so I'm not very good at answering your questions, but I'm here for you. Number to call, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria, Ton, and Sheridan with you this morning. We've been talking about planting in small spaces, and Sheridan, you thought it would be important that we also talk about succession planting.
Absolutely. Succession planting and interplanting both are really important practices to get more out of that garden space. So during the break, we were talking a little bit about successions where you would plant multiple crops or multiple successions of the same crop. So I do this to really irritate my kids sometimes. I'll plant, you know, beets once, and then a couple weeks later, I'll plant beets again. And then we have beets throughout the entire summer. And what do they not want? They don't want beets. I want them, but they don't. Yeah. Yeah, they're so good. But, you know, a teenager, that's not necessarily on their high priority to eat list. So they get upset with me. But it's a way to utilize that same space multiple times throughout the season, and also to get that crop to come up, you know, within a longer period of time. So instead of having to deal with this huge row of beets all at once, it gives me time to deal with them, you know, as they come on throughout that season because I have succession planted. And then also interplanting. And this is where, you know, maybe we'll plant, and this kind of gets muddy in the water. This is the succession planting and the interplanting. But maybe we'll plant, you know, French radishes early in the season, and those are really short-lived crop, and then those come out, and then I'm going to plant something else, or I plant them to the side. So I've got tomatoes growing, but to the side, those tomatoes aren't fully sized yet, so I can plant radishes or peas to the side or something like that, and then I can take those out and allow the tomatoes to continue to fill that space. And we're basically getting, you know, a two-for-one, getting a bigger bang for our buck in that space. We just kind of have to think outside the box a little bit.
You do. I mean, if you look at historic, we wouldn't really call them homesteading books, but books on how to grow vegetables if you were living on several acres with your family. This is just an accepted principle that every space in your garden has at least two different crops growing on it through the growing season, and in warmer areas up to three. And so you would start, as Sheridan said, maybe with French radishes. But as soon as those come out, you go back in with your tomatoes or even beets, and then the beets will grow for 45 to 60 days. And then if you have time, you go back in with your fall radishes or fall peas. And so there's several ways to do this. And we don't do it much anymore because we've had space and just, you know, we'd let it go fallow, or if we're really adventurous or wanting to get things done, we might put a green crop in there that you would mulch in later on. But when you were trying to support a family, you know, this was something that you just did, and it was part of gardening.
And I think it's a great practice to maybe think about reinstating, because you are moving. So think about it. You're moving from, you know, one family to the next as far as vegetables are concerned. So we're starting with radishes, and maybe we're going to tomatoes, or we're going to beets. And that is going to reduce the insect and the pathogen pest load in that space. We're essentially crop rotating at the same time, which is awesome, and helps to boost the nutritional value in the soil as well. So we're not constantly taking out the same nutrients out of that soil, you know, with the same crop.
And as you turn the waste in, it's adding organic matter back into the soil. You know, the useful part of the pea is the little pod or the seeds, but then that entire plant goes back into the soil and adds some nitrogen and organic matter. And so you're cycling that way too.
Yeah, it's really sustainable. I really like this idea.
Yes. And so one other thing I wanted to bring up before we go to break, we've got 3 or 4 minutes, is the importance of having pollinator plants in your garden, flowers. You know, my great aunt, I've talked about this several times, she had a huge garden, but always had rows of petunias and marigolds and peonies, and all the flowers she loved, she grew in her garden, interspersed with her vegetables. We might not be able to do that, but can you describe some ways and what you might grow to in a small space to encourage beneficial insects and pollinators?
Yeah, anything flowering is definitely going to bring in some of those insects. And we want things that are open, things that are easy for those insects to get into. So think about, you know, a double ruffled petunia. How easy is it for an insect to get into the center of that plant and access the pollen and the nectar in that plant versus an echinacea or a purple coneflower that is, you know, very open, very easy to access? So we're going to choose plants that are easy for them to get into. And I do this at my house. So in my park strip garden, I have it where it rotates. So I'm super weird here. I've got vegetables out in my park strip garden, but it rotates from, you know, pollinator plants two vegetables. And I have this kind of pattern that goes back and forth where they're kind of interspersed with each other. And it brings in so many pollinators. Anything native, I've got penstemon, I have hyssop. Hyssop is an incredible pollinator plant. You would not believe the diversity that shows up on hyssop.
You're talking the...
I've got a couple
Agastache.
Yeah, Agastache. I've got a couple of different types of it. Having those plants there, it boosts the amount of vegetable that I get because they are there pollinating and they just happen to swing by my other plants and do the pollination while they're there. Plus, I've got the beneficial insects that help keep things like aphids down. Last year, I had a problem with aphids on some of my brassicas, and I had the parasitic wasps come in and just decimate the aphids. It was incredible to watch.
Yeah, I would dare say that if you're growing pollinator plants with your vegetables and you have, what, 25-30% pollinator plants mm-hmm. to 2/3 vegetables, you will rarely even need to use an organic or insecticide
right.
in your garden.
Right. And I mean, if you can't get them into the vegetable garden, do them in your borders around the edges of your yard and get them there so that you have that access to those beneficials and the pollinators.
Okay, I want to squeeze Sue in here, who has been waiting very patiently on the line. Good morning, Sue. What was your question?
Good morning. I have a question about transplanting small trees. Right now they are growing about 3 feet from the mother tree, and I want to transplant them but also keep them both safe. What's the best way to dig those up?
Do you know what kind of tree it is?
Yes, I have a bur oak that has little saplings and also a lodgepole pine.
So they're probably seedlings, I'm assuming, if it's bur oak and not gamble. So I would dig that. At 3 feet, it doesn't seem like it's very tall, but the root system on that 3-foot little seedling is going to be very extensive. And so the sooner you can dig it, the better. When those are grown
right.
in nurseries, they're root pruned and trained a little bit. And so as soon as the ground is thawed enough to dig, I would move it.
Is there something special to keep from damaging the roots of the mother tree?
No. And you're not going to, if it's a great big tree, you're not going to do a lot of damage digging an 18-inch wide and 18-inch deep hole.
Okay. About 18 inches then.
At least, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call this morning. We're going to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. Coming back with more of your questions and calls. Number to call, 801-575-8255. Text us, 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis, Sheridan Hansen joining us this morning. You can give us a call at 801-575-8255 or text us at 57500. Next listener, Ton, wants to know, how do the sugar bay forsythia do along the East Bench in Salt Lake?
As long as they have a full sun exposure, most any forsythia will do fine.
Yeah, forsythia was the plant of the week, so you can find out more about
if
that.
If you are on the bench areas where the homes are, you're usually at an elevation that the way our atmospheric layers work and inversions work, the air is warmer than the valley floor where the homes are on the benches. And so most any forsythia, you're not going to run into much danger of bud damage from cold. So I would just find one you like and grow it.
And the forsythia, again, the plant of the week, you can find more on the Facebook page, the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. When is a good time to trim roses? People are getting excited. This is the second time this morning we've had this question.
So mid-March is the time to grow roses. And if you're getting too antsy, I'm selling a kit to help people not prune too early. And it involves giving the pruners away to somebody and
taping
you have a padlock, but then a rope that you can tie your hands together.
It's an intervention.
It's an intervention. And if you still can't stand it, then I'll give you a refund if you get a note from your significant other saying that you don't have the moral strength to stop pruning.
Wait.
And you get your refund. But yeah, but the point is be patient.
Okay. Next listener wants to know how to get rid of ants that have burrowed into the center of their snowball bushes and catalpa tree branches.
A bait. There's several of them out there. You might have to try two or three. They are either going to be an oil or fatty-based bait or a sugar-based bait. And the end of the season when the food supply starts to diminish from what they feed on is the easier time. But generally, Amdro makes several of them. Bear makes a few. There's many companies, but just to get to the queen, it takes a little longer. Instead of using Raid or Black Flag, use these baits and let the worker ants carry the poison back to the queen in the colony, and they will, through a process called trophallaxis, they regurge the food into the queen, and she eventually dies, and that kills the colony.
Ooh, thanks for sharing that.
Yes.
So, Sheridan, do you have a recommendation for a green pepper, someone's asking?
Oh, I love the, there's any pepper you can grow is a green pepper because it doesn't turn colors until later into the season. So you have, everything starts out as a green pepper. But California Wonder is a really good one. I love Yellow Monster. You can just pick it green and not let it turn yellow. But that one's really prolific and produces really long, pretty good-sized peppers.
A good cantaloupe to plant?
Ooh, I'm into ambrosia right now. That's kind of my favorite. I planted one by mistake, and that was the best mistake I ever made.
Ooh. Farm I worked on for years grew, I think, ambrosia is one of their varieties, and it was always a favorite.
Oh, it's so tasty.
Okay, Fred is on the line. I got to go to Bill first. Bill is on the line in Grantsville. Good morning, Bill. What was your question?
Good morning. My question is how to plant Brussels sprouts and if you have any recommendations for varieties.
So Brussels sprouts are tough. They're a really long season crop, like 120 days at least. So get them started soon, very, very soon in containers. Or you can source them from a nursery. They'll start them at the appropriate time. You've got to get them out into the garden as soon as possible, you know, usually early April to mid-April, depending on your weather. And then you're going to, you know, fertilize them appropriately, water them appropriately, decent amount of water. They don't like to be drought stressed. Make sure that you control aphids. That's going to be your biggest problem on Brussels sprouts is aphids. So you can just a strong stream of water every morning just really does help keep the aphids down. And then I like to pull off the bottom leaves as they grow. That gives the little Brussels sprouts an opportunity to really kind of size up. So as soon as you see those start to form under around those leaves, you can go and snip those leaves right off and then leave the top leaves on for photosynthesis. So they're going to kind of look like a palm tree. But you will not harvest the Brussels sprouts until end of October. So very long season crop, and it requires a lot of patience. You know, there are some really good standard Brussels sprouts. If you just go to Johnny's Seeds and look up Brussels sprouts, every variety that they sell on Johnny's is excellent. And there's a purple type, there's a green type that they sell. I've grown all of them, and they do very well. But it just requires patience.
All right.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your call. Next listener wants to know, Ton, when they can start pruning their lilacs into tree forms. Apparently their trees are about 5 years old.
Sometime after they stop blooming, just to get the flowers, if they don't really care and it's more important to get them trained sometime in mid-March.
Next listener says they used to grow a tomato plant named Heartland, and they loved it because of its compact size and beautiful tomatoes, and they can no longer find that variety, and they're wondering if there's anything similar.
You know, I have not grown that one myself. I'm seeing it at Sierra Vista Growers. I'm just pulling that up. But, yeah, it's a nice compact. It looks like a very nice compact type of tomato. But I would say, you know, it's a nice red, easy slicer. So even Better Boy would be an excellent substitute for that one. That one I found, you know, does get a little bit larger. Celebrity stays a little bit smaller. That would also work for that one. It looks very similar to that. But I am doing a quick search and I'm seeing it in a few places. So you might want to do a little search.
Okay.
You might want to do a little search and you might want to check out places like Seed Savers Exchange and some of those more informal sites where people just exchange.
Okay, let's go to the phone lines. Fred is on the line in Layton. Good morning, Fred. What was your question?
I'm looking for tips on pruning a rose of Sharon. It's in what they call a lollipop tree.
So it's on a single trunk?
Yes.
Okay, and what are you trying to do with it? Just keep it in shape or?
Yes, the shape.
I would use a process called renewal pruning to where you're taking a third of the oldest branches out and cutting it toward where not you know, don't get to do a pruning cut at the base, obviously, but toward where the bush actually is you're going to take a third of those branches and cut them as close to the middle of it as you can. And then you can give it a haircut afterwards. But if you cut a third of the branches out every year and then give it a light haircut, that will keep it in check. It'll kind of keep that ball shape and it'll keep it blooming like crazy through the last half of the summer.
It doesn't hurt them to cut the ends off.
No, they bloom off new growth. You don't just want to give it a haircut. You want to cut a third of the branches out every year so that, you know, you're always cutting out three-year-old branches, or at least 25%, so you're cutting out four-year-old branches, but you're taking the biggest branches out toward the middle.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for your call this morning. Next listener says, if they trimmed their roses last week, is that going to kill them with a big oops?
No, it's not probably going to get cold enough. I wouldn't worry too much. If we were getting down into single digits, maybe.
All right. We're going to take a break, come back with the final segment of the show. I'm not going to promote the phone lines or the text because we are getting close to the end and we have so many still to answer. So stay with us. Good morning and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse Show. Maria Ton and Sheridan taking your calls and questions for the last few minutes of the show here. Let's get to Alan, who's on the phone lines in Pleasant View. And good morning, Alan. What was your question?
Oh, can you hear me all right?
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay. I built a home a little over a year ago, and there was an old cherry tree that we just loved and wanted to try to keep. I would have to say, based on the property owners, that it could be nearly 50 years old. It's probably a little over 30 feet tall. And last spring, the leaves didn't come on too healthy looking, and it continued to get worse. They never turned yellow or fell off. They just didn't look vibrant. After we cut out some of the dead wood from the previous fall, some of the new branches that came out of the dock, they looked vibrant and green, but the whole rest of the tree, it just doesn't look good. My question is it salvageable? Do you fertilize them in the spring? And those are some of my questions.
Well, and Sheridan, you can chip in on this too. At 50 years old, I don't know, you know, short of doing some pruning and things, I don't know that it's worth trying to salvage the tree because it's just on the decline no matter what at that age.
And the height. I mean, how conducive is it to pick cherries 30 feet off the ground? I mean, so to me, in my mind, it's transitioned to a shade tree, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would go, if you like those old cherries, there's a 70% chance that it's Bing, which is still widely available. Maybe Lambert, because that was another wildly popular cherry back in the day. But I would go grab another Bing or a Lambert cherry and see if you can find them. And it's sometimes hard, but graft it onto maybe like Gisela 6 or Gisela 12, because those will max out at about 12 to 15 feet if you don't prune them.
Yeah, I it's not so much for the fruit as it is just the nostalgia of having a nice big old tree on a brand new piece of property.
Yeah, and it's just one of those things that it sounds like it has some vascular wilt in it, and sometimes pruning invigorates the tree temporarily, but within the next 5 to 10 years at the most, I think it's probably going to decline.
So plant a great shade tree or another cherry next to it while that one declines, and let, you know, while the other one gets growing, and then you'll have something when it's finally time
to
take it out.
I mean, you could plant another cherry on Mahalab rootstock, which will get that same size. It'll be 15, 20 years down the road, but you could put in a Bing cherry on Mahalab and it would be a great big tree.
Okay. All right. That was what I thought you would say. Because it feels like maybe at this point it's better to make some firewood and plant another tree.
Make some good smoking wood.
Yeah,
wood.
Thanks so
All right,
much
thank
for
you
your
much.
Call today. Next listener says they're wondering about the park strip, and I guess they're concerned about things that get sprayed on it, probably animal spray as well as salt spray, and they're wondering what would be some good things that you could plant in the park strip that you wouldn't have to worry about that will do well?
So I haven't had a problem with this, and I've been running a park strip garden for a number of years now. You know, the biggest concern I have is salt spray in the winter, and I do live on a corner piece of property that has a huge amount of park strip, and, you know, we do get a lot of snow up on the bench where I live. I haven't seen problems with it, but if you are concerned about that, you want to select plants that are tough, that are adapted to Utah soils and climate, that can withstand a little bit of salt. If somebody is coming and spraying herbicide on that park strip where you live, and that's something that shouldn't be done without your knowledge. So, you know, that's not normal practice in cities that I've dealt with when I worked with Extension. So, but I would definitely select things that are a little more water-wise, a little bit tougher. So look at some of those native plant lists and some of those adapted plant lists. There's some on the USU Botanical Center. If you look at the pollinator garden there, I have left a list there that you can look through.
All right. Next listener wants to know if you guys have tried the Azoichka or Cosmonaut Volkov tomatoes, and do they grow well here, and do they even taste good?
The Azoichka is a yellow tomato. I have not grown either of these varieties personally, but Azoichka is available through True Leaf Market, which is a local company. All of these tomatoes typically grow well here. They're an annual, so we're not going to be overwintering. So we're just growing for the season. It's usually not an issue to grow any of these types of tomatoes here. And then the Cosmonaut, that one is a more northern type variety. It looks like it withstands some of the colder temperatures, but it's a nice little red slicer tomato. And I have not grown that one either, but I don't foresee any problems with that growing here.
Next listener, Ton, has a 12 by 12 container garden. They want to know what product they should use to replace the nutrients in the soil. This is Mike, and he wants to know, when should he do it?
I actually would consider just replacing the soil every 2 to 3 years. If you're using potting soil, it decomposes over, especially after that second year, and it loses its good qualities. But in the meantime, I would just use an Osmocote Complete fertilizer or something similar, the slow release that has all the micronutrients in it. So these pots are going to be hard to reuse the soil over and over. And so after that, after I've gardened in that soil twice and grown different plants the next year, different species, I put it in a flower bed and just lightly rake it into the compost or soil in the flower beds and replace it.
Okay. Next listener, I think this is more of a comment than a question. They planted a wildflower bee mix into their garden from Territorial Seed. They didn't even know that there were that many different varieties of bees around, and they had thousands of bumblebees in their garden from little to bump. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Thousands of bees.
Yeah, that's awesome. Utah is a hot spot for native bee diversity. There are more species of bees here in Utah than there are in the entire eastern seaboard, basically. So we have over 1,000 different documented varieties. So native bees are incredibly important. And if you do plant, you will see a huge diversity.
Okay. Next listener says they had a bumper crop of English walnuts. Do you have any hints on how to crack them? The shell is so hard that the nutcrackers don't work. And any way to lessen the amount of shaft left on the nuts after they're cracked?
We're wanting our cake.
Whoa.
And eat it too on this
one. They're just tough ones, huh?
There are some commercial nutcrackers available that will not break with those hard walnuts. Mm-hmm. I've seen people make a shallow box tall enough for their car to drive over, and they drive over the nuts and then try to get them that way, a hammer. But those hard black walnuts are just something that are machine cracked, and they use the black walnuts in pastries and confectioneries because they have a stronger flavor, but they are very hard for homeowners to manually crack without a hammer.
Okay, next person lives in Huntsville. They believe that's a zone 5. Will a peach tree grow there? And what would you suggest is a good eating variety?
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, will Contender grow there? I think it might.
Yeah, it will.
So that might be your option.
That's probably the best one. Contender, even Red Haven probably would. It grows well in Logan, a PF24C. Madison is another one that's a pretty good peach.
Yeah. But, you know, you definitely don't want to grow some of those marginal
varieties.
No
Albertas.
Yeah, you want to stick to those
O'Henry's.
Tougher ones.
No
O'Henry's. What about apples?
Almost any apple.
Apples will do really well there.
I would avoid Fuji, avoid Honeycrisp, avoid
Pink Lady's Pink a little Lady. Too late.
But otherwise, anything that ripens up to Golden Delicious will be fine.
Yeah.
Okay, next listener says there was a purple red Tatsoi at home. Is that a, I don't know if that's an autocorrect, mild flavor for salads, very ornamental plant. Do you know that variety or can you recommend a variety?
So Tatsoi is like a bok choy. So okay. There are purple varieties out there. They all grow really well. The trick with these types of plants is to get them in the ground early and to succession plant because they will all come into use at the same time. So you want a succession plant, but you can choose really any variety. And these are cool season crops, so they won't do well once our temperatures are in the 80s, 85, 90.
Okay, next person says, when a seed catalog says for hoop house growing, are those different than those to start inside and then plant outside?
So hoop house growing, this is where we are growing like in a caterpillar tunnel. And so we're going to be starting these early. It's really commercial production. You can grow these out into your own vegetable garden. There's no reason why you can't.
A lot of the tomatoes I grow are hoop house varieties, and they do wonderfully outside.
Yeah.
Okay, next listener says, can they grow pine nuts in northern Utah County?
In theory. So
that's
we're
it.
Both
that's
looking
all
at
you're
each
giving
other.
Us.
Like, it's if you plant a Pinus edulis, what's the common name?
Pinyon pine.
Pinyon pine.
Yeah.
It will be 25 to 30 years before you ever get nuts off of it, at least sometimes up to 50.
So you might just want to go forage somewhere.
Plant it for the grandchildren.
Yeah.
Oh, that doesn't sound very satisfying.
No.
We just have about 30 seconds left. Sheridan, I want to thank you so much for being with us. We didn't get to one of my favorite topics, and that's unique types of vegetables people don't plant. We're going to have you come back.
Yeah, I'm happy to come back. Thank you so much for having me today. This has been a blast.
Thanks for being here. And we have done a number of videos that you can check out on the KSL Greenhouse YouTube channel on those unique vegetables, container gardening, how to plant early in the season, all sorts of things. So check those out. Anton, have a great week.
You also.
And thanks again for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Catch us on podcast.